It's time to get that hernia repaired. And who better to do it than a leading clinical facility? JBR Clinical Research is currently recruiting participants for an investigational pain reduction medication study following hernia repair surgery. If you're between the ages of 18 to 75, you may qualify to receive study-related medication and no-cost hernia repair by a board-certified surgeon. You may even be compensated up to $2,000 for time and travel. To participate, call 801-261-2000 or apply at jbrclinicalresearch.com.
Inside every California avocado is a story. It's shaped by idyllic conditions, full of rich soil, gentle rain, and friendly California sunshine, where avocados flourish. Crafted with care by dedicated local farmers who are committed to responsible, sustainable growing. The best avocados have California in them. To understand why, all you have to do is open one up. In season now. Visit CaliforniaAvocado.com to learn more.
This is Wheel Bearings. I'm Dan Roth from Forbes.
I'm Sam McGuall-Sammich from Guidehouse Insights. And Rebecca is off gallivanting with one of her friends tonight. So we will be doing another show with her again shortly. But
yeah,
not today.
She's the popular one.
Yeah. The two of us are stuck at home and when she gets to hang out with a friend.
Yeah, that's okay. Our dogs like us.
That's true. As long as I have treats.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's true. Well, not to derail us. What kind of treats does your dog like?
She likes chicken jerky and actually just about anything I give her, as long as it's something to eat.
Have you tried? Our dog is nuts about apples and carrots. If he hears you open the little bag of like the baby carrots, he'll come from whatever room he's in.
Daisy does like apples. She doesn't seem to be as fond of carrots. Rosie, our old dog, was a lot fonder of carrots. She loved to eat carrots, but Daisy's not as crazy about it. But she does love to have her evening Kong full of peanut butter and kibble.
All right. Yeah. Don't we all?
Yeah.
All right. Well, we can bring it around to cars. So the Kong, I was looking at that when we got it and I was like, that looks like a bump stop or a snubber.
Yeah.
It was apparently inspired by a Volkswagen bus transmission mount. The guy who,
that sounds about right.
Yeah. The guy who came up with that, he had a shop and his dog, just his German Shepherd or whatever, kept stealing one of the transmission mounts and gnawing on it. So it's like, all right, fine. We'll make one. At least that's the story. I don't know.
Well, the funny thing is when I prepare the Kong for Daisy every evening, you know, as soon as I pick it up, she knows, and she'll come and sit there just outside the kitchen area, sitting there calmly licking her lips the whole time while I'm filling it with peanut butter and kibble for her.
Yeah. And you go a little slower, make them drool.
Yep.
All right. Well, let's get to cars. So you have been driving the Hyundai Palisade.
Yeah. So I had the Palisade, all-wheel drive, 3.8, platinum, the high-end trim with pretty much every available option on it. And as we've talked about before, you know, I had a chance to take a first drive in it last summer when Hyundai was doing a regional drive program around here. Spent a couple hours driving it, and it was really impressive. And I think you've had it, and I know Rebecca's had it and talked about it.
I actually don't think I have had it.
Oh, you haven't driven the Palisade yet?
I don't think I've had the Palisade. That's like the one that I haven't had.
Okay. Well, it's interesting. You know, it's come out this year, you know, roughly the same time as the new Ford Explorer, you know, just after the Kia Telluride, which it shares a platform with. You know, we've got the new Toyota Highlander that's just launched. So you've got all these three-row SUVs, you know, in this segment, and you know, fresh product in there. And you know, this is in a lot of ways one of the best that's out there. It works really well. You know, it looks great. It's very roomy. It feels, you know, inside, you know, it's pretty close to the same size as the Explorer, but inside it feels more open, you know, and kind of feels a little wider. So you feel like you have more room to spread out than you do in the Explorer. At least that's the perception of it. You know, I think, you know, dimensionally it's not that far off, but it certainly feels roomier inside, especially in the third row. The third row is definitely roomier than in the Explorer. But, you know, whereas the Explorer went back to a rear drive platform this year, the Palisade is on a transverse engine front wheel drive platform. There's only one powertrain, the 3.8 liter Hyundai V6, which is a really good V6. Don't get me wrong, you know, 300 and some horsepower, 310, I think, or 315. You know, so it's totally competitive with anything else that's out there. You know, I had the all-wheel drive limited, which is their top trim level, not platinum. Sorry, it's 291 horsepower, 282 foot-pounds of torque.
Yeah, well, that it can be efficient too, though. I remember that from the Telluride too. It can do partial Atkinson cycle, or it can.
It can do some Atkinson cycle, effectively Atkinson cycle control under certain modes because it's got variable valve phasing. You know, so it's at least, you know, in theory, it can be very efficient. Being the first time that I've driven one for an extended period of time, I actually found the fuel economy to be a little less impressive than I expected. It's officially rated with all wheel drive at 21 miles per gallon combined. It's 19 city, 24 highway. I only got about 19 with it, you know, and I wasn't beating it up or anything. You know, I was driving it, you know, modestly the way I do anything else. And usually I managed to get pretty close to the label fuel economy number, but this one, did fall a couple miles per gallon short, you know, and, you know, compared to the rest of the segment, the Explorer's rated at all-wheel drive, 2.3 liter Explorer's rated at 23 combined, same for the Highlander with their V6. You know, the one thing that Hyundai doesn't offer on this is a hybrid powertrain. You know, so among the newer crop in this segment, the Ford and Toyota are both offering hybrid powertrains in here. Hyundai's not doing that. I think if you're looking for, you know, it's not that 19 is terrible for a three row SUV, but it's, you know, in 2020, it's not that impressive either. And I would think, you know, you should be able to do a little better than that.
Yeah, that's kind of like where fuel economy for these have been stuck for decades, like just forever. You know that you're going to get about 20 miles to the gallon.
Yeah,
it's good, but it's not.
A decade ago, you know, driving something like, you know, the first generation Chevy Traverse or, the Explorer, you know, a decade ago, you know, 18, 19 miles per gallon was about what you were going to get. So it hasn't really improved that much. I do expect, Hyundai has, made it clear that they're going to be launching a bunch more electrified powertrains. Whether or not the current generation Palisade is going to get a hybrid system in it at some point in its life cycle, I don't know. I'm guessing it's probably not, but some of their other smaller ones, like the upcoming Tucson that's launching later this year. I would think the Santa Fe will probably get a hybrid system in it, but I'm not sure about the Palisade.
Well, now the Santa Fe and the Palisade, they share a lot under the skin, right? It's still a similar platform.
Yeah. It's similar, same architecture, but the Palisade is, you know, it's been stretched quite a bit. It's longer, wider than the Santa Fe. So, it could get one. The thing is, up to this point, Hyundai has only done their hybrid with their four cylinder engines, with the 1.6 liter or the 2 liter four cylinder engines. And I'm not sure if that 2 liter hybrid combination is going to be enough for a vehicle the size of the Palisade. If they do a 2.5 liter with the hybrid system, that could be workable, and that would certainly be competitive with the new Highlander, which also has a 2.5 liter four cylinder and hybrid. And that, the Highlander hybrid is rated at 35 combined. So,
yeah. Well, it's funny how we're like, we've made a lot of progress, but we're still at this point where the regular fuel economy of a crossover of this size is mediocre at best, which I think that's just physics. You can't really get around it. And then
When you have to move 2.5 tons, you know, it's going to take a certain amount of energy.
And I remember those first, the first Chevy Traverse or the Lambdas, like the Buick Enclave. The fuel economy those they got was like 15 when we first got them in the fleet. So we were all excited for them, and it was just like, oh my goodness, that's bad. But they're really heavy. They were really heavy. They've made a lot of improvements. But, you know, we're also looking at hybrid systems that seem to have a little trouble scaling, which is like, that was the thing way back when too, was it seems like Hyundai's hybrid system can't scale like it would need to for a larger vehicle.
Right. And I think, you know, that was part of Ford's rationale in going rear wheel drive with the new Explorer. I mean, among other things is, you know, they were developing a hybrid system for the F-150, and they did that when, you know, they designed it as a modular system that could slap into anything with rear wheel drive that they had, because it was based around their new 10 speed automatic. And then they just slot in an electric motor in between the engine and the torque converter. And, you know, they can scale up that motor to various sizes. So the one that's in the Explorer hybrid is, I think it's a 44 horsepower motor. And then, you know, for the Aviator Grand Touring, the plug-in hybrid, it's a 96 horsepower version of that. So it's just a physically larger motor with more power and torque for that particular application. And we'll see which one in a couple of weeks, which one they use in the new F-150 hybrid. But, you know, it's based on that same architecture, but it was specifically designed to scale to a variety of different applications.
Yeah. Well, and it seems like if you're doing a, you know, longitudinal layout, it can handle that a little bit more gracefully, because, you know, larger motor is going to make it'll move where the engine is, right? Where if you're doing that in a transverse layout, you're basically affecting the width of the package.
Right.
And it may not fit.
Yeah. You've got a little more packaging space to work with in that longitudinal configuration. Cause you know, all you're doing is maybe shifting the transmission back by a couple of inches.
Yeah. Well, it just went really geeky. Okay.
Yeah.
So tell us more about the Palisade though. Like the thing that I noticed about it, not having driven it, but just sort of comparing it with the Telluride, which I really, really liked, was they seem to be two different flavors and both very distinct. They have different personalities, which is really interesting to me because they share so much.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the interior of the Palisade, you know, especially in the limited trim level that I had, you know, feels really upscale. You know, it's really nicely executed, really nice materials. You know, there's a little bit of, you know, fake wood trim on the dash, but it doesn't look, you know, unlike, you know, we were talking last time about the Altima, you know, where it really doesn't look like real wood. You know, this looks a little more authentic. The instrument panel and center display, you know, spans across, you know, in one unit, you know, and you've got a full digital instrument cluster, and then the touchscreen off to your right, and it's a 10.5-inch display, you know, with a new interface, but it's different from the Hyundais of the past 5 or 6 years, but it's still pretty easy to use. Even the built-in voice recognition works really well. It's pretty robust. One of the cool features that they have on they actually have it on a number of Hyundai models now, Hyundai and Kia models, is using the side cameras that are on the underside of the mirrors to give you a view similar to what Honda's had with their lane watch system. We have it on our Civic, but Honda only has it on the passenger side. So when you put on the turn signal, the right turn signal, it shows you the view from that camera of what's on your right-hand side, which, you know, if you're turning right, is usually just the curb. So it's not really all that useful most of the time, and it shows up in the center display, which means that to see it, you've got to look over at the center screen. And if you're going to do that, you might as well just look at the mirror. What Hyundai's doing is they're actually showing that display in the digital instrument cluster. So the standard configuration in the digital cluster is the speedometer on the right, tachometer on the left. When you put on the turn signal, it'll show you the view from either camera in the corresponding circle. So when you turn on the, when you put turn signal onto the left, it shows you the view from the camera in the speedometer display, in the center of the speedometer display, or, you know, the to the right, it shows it in the tach display. And then, you know, so you basically kind of have a duplicate of what you're seeing in the mirrors, but it's always properly aimed. And it's not there all the time. It's only, you know, to give you a quick check of your blind spot when you're changing lanes or turning. So, you know, I think the system works really well. On the Telluride, they have that system, but because the Telluride doesn't have the full digital cluster, it only has the analog gauges and then the display in between those. It actually shows you both the left and right in that central display in between the two gauges, whereas this shows it on, you know, in, separately on either side. So it kind of ties in a little better, and you know when you glance down, you know which one you're looking at.
Yeah, the Sonata Hybrid that I had the last show did that as well. And it's better than the Honda Lane Watch system, but it's still, to me, after having spent a few decades driving with mirrors, it just doesn't feel right. I guess there's probably drivers that aren't checking their mirrors and don't have their mirrors set well anyway, so it probably can't hurt for them, but it still feels weird. I like the way Hyundai did it a little better, but it's still, to me, like I want to be looking at that mirror, not at the,
and I, you know, I do too. I glance over, you know, I have that muscle memory of, you know, when I tap the turn signal lever, I look over to one side or the other to the mirrors and, you know, quick glance over my shoulder, my peripheral vision, before I make a move one way or the other. But, you know, as anybody that's driven on American roads knows, there's a lot of drivers that don't look.
Yeah.
So, you know, if it's right in front of them, you know, then it's better than nothing.
Yeah, and it's quicker. It's quicker, I think, than Lane Watch. Lane Watch, the problem, one of the big issues was there's just a sort of display for it to, like, finally get around to popping the thing up, and you'd already have made your change.
Yeah, exactly.
Where this seems to just react a little quicker. And that digital cluster is really nice in the Sonata. I'm sure it's very similar.
Yeah, it's the same cluster display. It's the same hardware. And largely the same interface, you know, same graphics on there.
Yeah, that's one of the things that Hyundai continues to do really well. And I almost would pick their cars over some of their competition because they're just easy to operate. Even with the infotainment and stuff, you can get in, you can figure it out. They've got the right amount of redundant controls for the most part. And it just all really is, you don't need to crack the manual for most stuff. It just works. And that's actually pretty hard to do. And so they've been putting in the effort to make that happen. And it makes the experience a lot better.
No, that's absolutely true. And, you know, between the good user experience of the way you interact with the vehicle and, you know, just the way it looks and feels around you, you know, it feels very, you know, it feels very high quality, and, you know, it is, but, you know, the perception you get sitting in it, it feels like a more expensive vehicle than it is. And, you know, certainly at $47,000, it's not cheap, but, you know, you can easily spend a lot more on an SUV and not have something that feels as premium as this does.
Yeah. And it's an interesting trick. You know, some of it is sleight of hand, right? It's just picking the right patterns and colors and textures and arranging them properly. So it doesn't actually have to be expensive to look expensive, or it doesn't have to be as expensive as it looks. But they're really, really good at it.
Well, and it's, you know, it's also a matter of, you know, how you put it together, where, you know, the way you design it, you know, with where the seams are, you know, where parts join up to each other. And, you know, again, this goes back to what I was talking about last time with the Altima, you know, the trim, the plastic trim around the center touchscreen display in the Altima it's right there in your face. You know, you've got these two halves, you know, there's a seam that separates the two halves of this kind of shell, you know, around the base of that screen that stands up on the middle of the dash. And it looks so out of place there. You know, it grabs your attention. The first time you glance at it, it grabs your attention and you realize how cheap it looks compared to a lot of other elements of the interior. And, you know, a Hyundai has done a really good job of avoiding that sort of thing, of not having, and a lot of manufacturers are increasingly doing that, of, you know, getting the pieces lined up in a way that you don't see those seams, or they're not as obvious. And, you know, the pieces that are hard plastics, you know, are down below the dashboard where you're not going to see them, you know, down by your knees. So, you know, the pieces that you see and touch 99% of the time are the ones that feel really good and look really good.
Yeah. And it's always a struggle. It's interesting. Nissan just had a little, meeting for us, here in New England, and they had one of the designers, from their La Jolla, studio. They had Hiran Patel, talk to us, and I guess he's the lead designer, but that was one of my questions, was how do you figure that out? Because it doesn't have to necessarily cost more to look like it costs more. It doesn't have to be expensive to just pay attention and work with the, you know, the production side of things, so they can understand what you're trying to do and say, you know, if you had the gaps here or there, or you know, made this one piece instead of two. And I'm sure there's all that back and forth, and that's what he said, was like, look, everything's a fight on every car, and you know, some you win, some you don't. And they're always like, you know, they're always sort of getting buy-in from other disciplines, and some stuff just happens that way. Yeah. So it's
well, you know, and the other aspect of that is it also has, you have to be able to build it.
Yeah.
You know, it's not as simple as just designing it in a certain way, but you actually have to design it so that you can put it together in the factory.
Right. And like, there's things like cycle times and stuff, mm-hmm. that come into it. Like, yeah, if it takes 10 minutes to put that one piece in, like, no, that's not going to work. So, the Hyundai though, like the thing that I think you could take from, especially the Palisade, but most of their lineup, it's almost like a little masterclass in the importance of design and how it shapes perception. Because you look at the Palisade and it's, you know, it's basically a minivan. It's front wheel drive based. It's a crossover, but it looks more like a Tahoe.
Yeah.
In some ways, you know, it's got that, there's that idea of the premium gap, right? With the way the stance is, it doesn't really have front wheel drive proportions, that they've pushed the wheels out a bit. It just has that more traditional SUV stance. The clean lines on the body, give it that perception, I think, of premium, and the way they've surfaced it, you know, it's spare, it's not gimmicky. Whereas you compare it to something like the Highlander, it looks, to me, it looks good, but there was a lot of complaining.
Yeah.
when that debuted a few weeks ago, and you know, the trim choices are pretty understated. And then inside, it's the same thing. It's just, you know, just the way they've, you were talking about how wide it feels, you know? And so they, I'm assuming they probably emphasize the horizontal aspect, so it feels wider because there's a lot of horizontal lines versus the Ford that may have more vertical elements to sort of box you in. And that's coming from the creative side of things. That's the fascinating part, is how it messes with people's heads.
Yeah. I mean, you create these optical illusions that, you know, something, you know, if you take a measuring tape to it, it's not any different, but when you sit in it, you know, the impression that it creates is completely different. And speaking of, you know, impressions, you know, I talked about the infotainment interface, and you know, this is another area where Hyundai did it right. You know, with, they've got the same size screen that Ford has in the Explorer and the premium Explorers with a 10-inch screen. But Ford, you know, decided, you know, to, when they, at some point, you know, it almost feels like it was an afterthought. You know, they decided to add the 10-inch screen, but they, it had to fit in the same space between the vents on the dashboard as the 8-inch screen. And so the base 8-inch screen setup is a landscape display. The 10-inch is a portrait display. And they did kind of a half-assed job on reconfiguring the Sync 3 interface for this bigger display, for this reoriented display, because it was, the Sync 3 was designed for a portrait style display. And, you know, on the 10-inch portrait display, you know, there's a lot of wasted space that doesn't, you know, they didn't reconfigure everything properly on that one. And, you know, fortunately, from what I've seen so far with Sync 4, you know, they've addressed that, because they right up front, they knew they were going to do both portrait and landscape displays. But, you know, it's another thing where there's this detail that Ford kind of missed out on with the Explorer, that, you know, Hyundai didn't have to deal with that.
Yeah. The Explorer is an interesting case, because they sort of like fumbled that launch, I feel. It's just too bad, because it looks good, and by all accounts, they'll smooth it out, but it's a little disappointing in how it was executed when it was sort of getting out of the gate.
Well, speaking of the Explorer, there was Jim Farley and Jim Hackett did a talk this week at a Deutsche Bank conference, and the web, you know, it's available as a webcast. The replay of the presentation is available online. I'll drop a link to it in the show notes. But Farley talked about the Explorer launch in the Q&A. You know, he was asked about that, or actually even in the main presentation before he was asked about it. You know, he talked about, you know, with the Explorer, he acknowledged that they made a lot of mistakes with the Explorer launch. He said, you know, it's because they had to completely gut the plant, the Chicago assembly plant, and reconfigure it all to build this thing, because previously they were building the old front wheel drive based Explorer and the Taurus there. And, you know, so they had a completely new architecture here. So they completely redid the assembly line, and that they made a lot of mistakes there, and that's what caused them problems. You know, and he talked about, you know, they're about to launch the new F-150. This summer, and, you know, they've already launched the Escape. You know, and he said, you know, for the F-150, you know, because they already went through that process of completely rebuilding the plant with the, in 2015 or 2014, when they launched the current generation, and the new one, it's going to be a lot smoother transition into this new generation.
Yeah, it's still surprising, though, when a company that's been at it for so long, like Ford, I know it's a big change and it's significant. It's a completely different architecture and all that. But you'd think that they would have it down.
You would think so, but, you know, I mean, certainly Tesla is not the only one that can screw up a production launch. You know, every manufacturer has done it at some point in time.
Yeah, well, and it's refreshing that they're that forthright about it.
I was surprised he talked about it to the degree that he did.
I like Jim.
Yeah, he's a good guy.
All right, well, so in my driveway, until they came and took it, was the 2020 Infiniti QX50 Autograph all-wheel drive, which was a real bit of just really the cosmos coming together for us, because the last episode we were talking about the Nissan Infiniti VCT 2-liter 4-cylinder that you had in the Altima. And I remember saying, like, well, I'll have to pay more attention to how smooth it is, because you seem to think that it was one of the smoother 4-cylinders on the market. And that was one of the things that Nissan was saying too, was the design of that engine, because of the extra elements in there, actually smooths it out without needing balance shafts. So somebody listened.
So what did you think?
Yes, the engine is smooth in terms of vibration. It makes good power. It doesn't shake the car. I think what, for me, gets a little bit sideways there is the engine note is not the most refined. There are other Fords that sound better. I know it's kind of a picky thing, and maybe I'm being hard on it, but it's still a little bit raspy. It's not really a car. This isn't a car for you if you are buying it for the sound of the engine at, you know, like 4,500 RPM, though. that's not what the QX50 is for. You know, and the power is good. It's a really neat piece of engineering. Driving it, I felt like it was a little bit disappointing. So when you had it in the Altima, did you have it with a CVT or do they have a conventional? Okay.
No, so, it was a CVT.
So that's, I think, what makes the engine sort of feel like it's on its own little island. It's fine around town, you know, and at speed, once you get to speed, it's fine. You know, no gear changes, which is probably the right decision for the character of this car in particular. But also, you know, it's another thing that they can say with the Altima is, hey, isn't it really smooth? You don't feel that jerking from gear changes. And that's true. When you need the power, it does that sort of motorboating thing that CVTs will do. And it's like double rubber bandy because, you know, you've got, it has to build boost, which is pretty quick about, but it also has to get to the right ratio. And those things never seem to just happen exactly when you want them. And that's not really a big deal, I think, for the people who are going to buy it because they're not going to drive it that way. But, you know, it feels like a lot of tech that gets wasted that goes because it goes through a transmission that just doesn't care. And I have to back up a little bit and when I'm thinking about it and say, look, the point here was not to make a performance engine. It was to make an engine that is lighter and more compact than the VQ, which is the only other engine they have, right? It's the V6, which is, it's an old design. It's good in some ways. I've really liked the VQ, but that's also not a refined sounding engine. It's thirsty. And I'm sure it's hard to clean up the emissions compared to a newer design. Like, there's a lot of reasons to go with a newer engine. And rather than do a harder to package V6, hey guys, we can do a 4-cylinder. We can dial the power up and down with software and boost. It fits a lot of places across however, you know, many platforms they've got or just, you know, in a lot of different engine rooms that make it harder. I think when you're designing for multiple engines and the weight of it helps them make other pieces around it lighter. So there's the reason for this engine is to replace the VQ. It's not to excite the enthusiast, although I really want to try it in the new Z, if that's what they wind up doing. Cause I think it will be wonderful with either a, you know, step ratio automatic or a manual transmission behind it.
Yeah. It could be really interesting. I don't know if they'll do it with a manual. In fact, I would, at this point, I'd be surprised if they do another manual, but a step ratio automatic or, or a DCT,
yeah,
I think is definitely a possibility. You know, I mean, they could potentially use, you know, maybe a version of the DCT from the GTR, or, you know, there's other DCTs out there on the market that they could use. But that would be a fascinating thing to try out. Cause you've got, you know, similar power to the VQ, but, you know, in a very different kind of package.
Yeah. And I honestly, like, I came to that realization. I was like, hang on a second. I'm going about this opinion wrong. It's just like, it's there to make X amount of kilowatts really. And just provide the power. It's not there for excitement. It's not there for any of those visceral things that we care about. It's there because it's a smaller, more efficient way to make the same amount of energy.
Yep.
For the drivetrain. So with that in mind, it's fine. You know, the QX50 is, I'm trying to think now, cause it's the model name, the model itself, it's now in the second generation, but the QX moniker started off as the EX, right? It was the EX35 and then the EX.
Yeah. It was EX35 or was it EX30? I think it might've been EX30 originally. I think it was a 3 liter back when I first did a review of it for Autoblog back in 2009-ish, I think, 2008 or 9. Yeah, I think it was EX30.
That was a long time ago now.
Yeah. Well, you know, that first generation one was, it had a long product run.
It did.
And it changed pretty significantly, partway when they did their mid-cycle refresh. They actually, it was a pretty substantial update because they actually stretched the wheelbase by about 3 inches.
And it made it much better. And so that one had a lot of character because it was based on the G35, G37, the FM sedan and coupe. That made it also not all that space efficient, not all that fuel efficient. So it had character and it felt luxurious and it felt sporty, but it couldn't hold that much. Yep. And it didn't go that far on a tank of gas. And it was maybe a little bit more toward the side that would please enthusiasts, but sort of put off the luxury buyer. So I think they've made the right decisions going with a front-wheel drive transverse architecture. It looks good on the outside. It's restrained and handsome, and Infiniti does beautiful interiors. And this one being the autograph trim, it's really, really nice inside. It's a nice combo of tan and brown leather and just nice materials everywhere you looked. Very comfortable. Has a newer infotainment, which I think probably shares a lot with what was in the Altima. The touchscreen. It's not a huge touchscreen, but it's not the quaint Nissan system that we had for a very long time as well, with the old Windows 3.1 graphics and a little rotary controller. That system actually worked and it was really friendly. This system is pretty easy to use. The touchscreen's a little sluggish, it's a little clunky, and it's a shiny plastic cover, so I just wonder how long that's going to hold up. But it's not bad. It's not real obtuse. The voice recognition, I tried it because Rebecca always asks me, did you try the voice recognition? So I did. I tried it, and it couldn't find the road I was looking for. So it couldn't understand me, I guess. So I have to give it a demerit for that. Infiniti has...
It's got the dual screen setup, doesn't it?
I'm trying to remember.
I'm looking at it right now. It's got dual touch screens. So there's one above, which is primarily for the nav system, and then the one below that has, it's mainly for the entertainment, media, and other controls.
Okay. I'm trying to think, because it's like none of it felt clunky though. It did have the dual screens. But it didn't, that didn't bug me, strangely enough. Where in other cars it does get kind of aggravating. That didn't actually bother me. To the point where I had to go look at a picture to remember.
It's not as bad as the setup that Acura had for many years. It definitely works better than that one.
Yeah, the Acura setup you couldn't figure out how to use.
Yeah.
It's like, wait, this one is a touchscreen?
Yeah, no.
One's not?
This one, this one, at least the Infiniti system, is fairly easily, logically configured, with, the maps and stuff are all on the upper screen, where it's closer to line of sight, and, other stuff, climate controls and radio and everything are in the lower screen.
Yeah, no, I didn't hate any of it. It all actually worked pretty well, and the touch targets are a decent size on that lower screen, and there's enough physical controls and stuff. So they've done a lot of the ergonomics right, which is always it always makes you a little scared when they do a complete redo and get creative with things. But they've done a really nice job, and I really love the aesthetic inside. It's their designers are doing a nice job with Infiniti in particular. The design has always been really good with the brand, and it shows here. Just it feels nice, and it looks good. And they have some things that are unique to the brand, like the silvery wood trim. I remember back a ways now where they brought out it a little more subtle, but it was in one of the M, I think, sedans. They had like flecks of silver in the wood. It was more of like a traditional wood grain. This is like open pore kind of stuff. But it's just things like that where they do pay attention to those details, and that's what you expect in a luxury car. And so it gives you that sort of feeling like it's not just a Nissan with a fancier badge. And I think this actually may be a Mercedes, right? This is the one that they share with Mercedes?
No, that was the QX30. Okay. That was the little one. It was based on the GLA.
But, it, you know, and also, like, this goes down the road nicely. The thing that I guess I wish they would figure out a little better is Infiniti has this feeling, this desire, I guess, to push the envelope technically and with things that not every other manufacturer is really after right now. Like the steer by wire is my biggest complaint. I had the QX a while ago back in March or February, and it was the same thing. And I had it during like a rainstorm at night and just trying to feel what the hell kind of traction I had or, you know, where the lane was. I hated that. I hated it to just like, I was like, I cannot wait to be out of this car in these conditions. And it still feels really, really numb. And I don't know how you get around that with steer by wire. It's so artificial that it's really hard to tell what's going on with the tires. And I feel like that actually, even for the like regular driver, that is an issue because you're not going to know what kind of grip you have and what's actually going on. It's too much like a video game. The other stuff feel, you know, it seems okay, but that particular bit of steer by wire, just that kills the whole thing for me. The rest of it, I love it otherwise, but it needs to not have steer by wire.
Yeah. I think, you know, as long as we still have to actually drive the vehicles, you know, it's probably better to stay with mechanical systems for stuff like that.
Yeah. But, or you know, way.
Even a lot of cars that have mechanical steering, you know, still don't have the greatest steering feel. Look at a lot of recent BMWs. So
yeah.
no guarantee that actually having a physical connection there is actually going to be much better.
Yeah. It doesn't necessarily have to be a physical connection. And I know that it's really hard to do this stuff. So later generations of it are going to get better, but it just, it's funny how subtle it is. Like even with that bad steering, say in one of the 3 series, it's still better than having nothing.
Yeah.
Like, so it's a weird subtle thing. So they'll zero in on it. They'll get there. The other thing I sort of thought about as I was driving this was, instead of the VCT engine, I'm curious why Infiniti hasn't considered going hybrid. This seems like just the right product to go hybrid with in that market. You know, you can certainly get the performance out of a hybrid setup. I think a PHEV would really, really be a good move. It's the right size. It's just lovely. It's a premium product, and you know, premium hybrid buyers are there in the CUV market. And it's not like the engine was cheap to do either. So maybe a hybrid would be financially about the same. I don't know, but and maybe they just don't have a hybrid to put into it. But I really felt like, as fun as this is with this engine, or as good a power as this engine makes, like I feel like they could have gotten that same kind of oomph out of electrification.
Yeah, I agree. You know, I think Nissan, for whatever reason, seems to have had a hard time committing to hybrids in any form. You know, each time that they've launched one, you know, it hasn't been very long lived. You know, they had one for a while in the Rogue. They had one for a while in the Pathfinder, and you know, back in the day, they actually licensed Toyota's hybrid system for the Altima for a couple of years, and then discontinued that. And you know, I think next episode we'll talk more about that stuff. I can't talk about yet, it's under embargo for now. But yeah, I mean, Nissan seems to have a real love-hate relationship with hybrids. But you know, this they have said that they're going to launch Infiniti models with their e-Power system, which is actually a series hybrid system. You know, so they refer to that as an electric powertrain that you never have to plug in. You know, and that one's got in the versions they have in the Japanese market today, you know, their lower power versions, where you have an electric motor that powers the wheels, and then a relatively small battery and an engine that runs a generator. You know, so there's no mechanical connection between the engine and the wheels at all. The engine is just charging the battery, and then the thing runs on electricity. So, you know, that's coming. I believe they're going to launch their first Infiniti e-Power model in 2021. But, you know, this, you know, the QX50 would, you know, in the segment it's in, you know, this premium, you know, midsize crossover segment, you know, against the likes of, you know, certainly the Lexus RX and the, you know, some of the Germans, you know, you've got the Audi Q5 and the BMW X3, you know, those have plug-in hybrid options available to them. It would seem like a logical option in this kind of vehicle, but, you know, for some reason, Infiniti has chosen not to do it.
Yeah, it's surprising because it's not like it's cheap. You know, it was $59,000.
Yeah.
So I can't imagine that you couldn't find some way. And they're charging you, right, for that VCT engine. So I can't imagine that they can't make the numbers work for a hybrid. Well, I can actually imagine that a hybrid would still be more expensive than the engine with the batteries.
Not necessarily. I mean, if you're talking about a non-plug-in hybrid, you know, the cost premium for those has come down quite a bit. You know, it's probably somewhere between $1,500 and $2,000 now at, you know, manufacturing cost premium. And, you know, that's, you know, you're probably looking pretty close to that to do that VCT engine compared to a conventional four cylinder.
Yeah. And it's just, I guess it's two different approaches.
Yeah.
But, you know, and it would allow them to sort of bump their fuel economy, which isn't great either. It's, you know, 25 combined. That to me, this is kind of a small vehicle to get mileage that low. These days, everything seems a bit more efficient. But it, you know, it's a nice place to be.
Yeah.
You know, if you're not driving it at night in the rain with no steering feel. so it's got some things to work on. It's a good choice. It feels solid otherwise. And it's comfy and handsome and, it's a contender. At least it has some things that are unique about it. That's nice. It's not totally nondescript. But I do find some of the choices curious, but, you know, they give some areas of improvement, right? They'll do it like an employee review. Like, these are the things you need to work on. We could stick with hybrids because Ford just announced the mileage, the electric only mileage numbers for their Escape PHEV. And we knew this was coming, but we didn't know it was going to do 37 miles on a charge, right?
Yeah, they had indicated, you know, when they first launched the Escape just over a year ago, when they did the reveal of the Escape and told us about the plug-in, that it would be doing somewhere, you know, at least 30 miles of range. And that's in part, you know, driven by, you know, the fact that they sell versions of this vehicle as the Kuga in Europe and in China. And, you know, to get the most, you know, a lot of the incentives, especially in China, are, you know, there's a threshold of, you know, getting at least 30 miles of electric range in order to get some of those, some of the maximum incentives on this thing. And so they ended up at 37 miles of electric range from a 14.4 kilowatt hour battery and 100 miles per gallon equivalent, you know, in the overall combined driving cycle, which, you know, that range is a little bit less than what Toyota's been promising for the RAV4 Prime, their plug-in hybrid, but the efficiency is a little bit better. So Toyota is projecting 42 miles and 94 mpg. So, you know, we're not sure, you know, Toyota hasn't revealed any other details about the RAV4 plug-in, you know, as far as battery size or anything. So it may well have a larger battery than the Escape does. But, you know, either way, I mean, this 37 miles of electric range is great for this thing. You know, that's better range than the first generation Chevy Volt got when it launched a decade ago. That one only got 35 miles. So you're getting 37 miles in a much more usable package. You know, the battery, you know, modern batteries, you know, are, you know, much more compact. They're much, you know, better energy density than they were in the past. So the whole battery pack fits under the rear seat. But unfortunately that also means that, that it blocks off the passage where a drive shaft would go for all wheel drive. So you can only get the Escape plug in with front wheel drive. When the Corsair plug in launches later this year, it's going to have all wheel drive, but with an electric motor on the rear, which is the same as what Toyota does on the RAV4.
Well, I mean, you gotta, you know, keep those things distinct so you can have something different for that brand, right?
Oh yeah. No, absolutely. You know, but so for, you know, anybody that wants an all wheel drive plug in crossover, you know, the Escape is not going to be the one for you, unfortunately. But you know, the other thing is the Escape, you know, is going to be significantly cheaper than the RAV. The Escape plug-in starts at just over 33,000, and it's eligible for about a $6,400 federal tax credit because of the size of the battery. So, you know, you're going to be looking, you know, starting price, you know, effective starting price somewhere around 27,000 for the Escape plug-in hybrid. And, you know, 37 miles of range is going to be enough for most people to do pretty much all their regular driving without using any gas.
Yeah. No, I mean, especially with regular driving now, I filled up once in the last 4 months.
Right. Well, I mean, you know, even, you know, under more normal circumstances, you know, it's still going to be plenty of electric range for most people. And, you know, you plug it in when you come home at night, unplug it in the morning. And you know, when you're driving around during the day, you don't have to worry about, unlike with a battery electric vehicle, you don't have to, you know, perhaps worry about, you know, finding a place to charge during the day. You know, or if you want to take a road trip, you know, with the family, you know, you don't have to necessarily plan for where you're going to stop, you know, for charges along the way. You can just keep driving it just like a regular hybrid.
Yeah. Well, that's one of the things, you know, range anxiety isn't so much a thing anymore. But it still factors in especially when you're considering the purchase of a single vehicle to do it all. And certainly the Escape is in that class where it will be the family vehicle. It will have to do it all. You know, you think about the same way that the RAV4 does, you know, that is the new family wagon. And so, yeah. To be able to do it all sort of gracefully and not run out of juice is really important in that segment. So that's still an area where there is some range anxiety, because they're not, you know, they're not true believers, they're not early adopters, but at this point they're people that, you know, would be happy to spend a little bit extra and be able to cover most of their driving on a daily basis with electric instead of using gas. So it seems like a good move, I'm surprised at the price, because the last Escape I had, I was surprised in a bad way. It seemed expensive, and it actually seems a little tighter in terms of space, but maybe that's, again, the design stuff tricking us. Like, how does it actually sort of fit in that segment? I really feel like the RAV4 is the king in terms of just space, size, utility, all of those things. That's a really, really,
they're actually, you know, their dimensions are almost exactly the same.
Are they really? See, the Ford feels tighter.
Yeah. You know, I haven't driven the Escape since last summer, so I have to go back and remember, but you know, it didn't seem to be that much different to me. But you know, price wise, you know, the SE plug-in hybrid starts at just over 33, and then there's all, you can also get the SEL and the titanium, and the titanium is about 39,000. Right. But the thing is, you know, that SE, you know, with that $6,400 tax credit, you know, that brings it down to about 27, which actually makes it cheaper than the SE hybrid, the regular hybrid SE, which is 28. So it's about $1,000 less. So, you know, if you buy one of these, you know, in the next year or so, you'll still be able to get that credit, you know, probably by sometime around the middle of 2021, Ford will have hit the 200,000 mark, and they'll be phasing out their tax credits. But at least for now, you can still get that. And, you know, that really makes it a good deal.
Yeah. And I guess you have nowhere to go if you want all-wheel drive. So you do have to leave Ford, unless you want to go to Lincoln.
For that, you'll have to go to Toyota for the RAV4, which is going to start at about 38 and a half.
Yeah. So it's a couple grand more for the.
Yeah. It's about a $5,000 price difference for the minimum price.
That's true.
But the RAV will also have a tax credit available on it as well, which will bring it down to about 32.
Yeah. It's a competitive market.
It is very competitive. Yeah. And then you got the CRV hybrid that Rebecca drove last time, you know, which they don't have a plug-in version of that yet, but just the regular hybrid. But yeah, I mean, there's a lot of hybrids, and, you know, as I mentioned earlier when we were talking about Nissan and hybrids, you know, I'll have more to say about that next week.
Let's see what you have to say about Nikola Motors. the best takes I saw were, you know, Patrick George summed it up really nicely, where he said that they don't make anything. They have no profit, and yet they're valued more than more than General Motors, which makes absolutely no sense. Although
there is nothing about the stock market today that makes any sense whatsoever.
That's any absolutely way. True.
Nikola
seems to have, like, we had talked about him a little bit a few weeks ago or a few shows ago, because they had the pickup that seemed really promising. And they're sort of working in long haul trucking or, you know, heavy trucks, which is really, I think, the place where you're going to find a lot of adoption and actual, like, you probably have an actual road to profitability there if you can do it well, versus, you know, selling fancy electric cars to wealthy people. But
yeah, you know, so Nikola, when they first came out a few years ago, when they first became public, you know, they announced a long haul truck, you know, an electric long haul truck. And this was before Tesla revealed the Semi. The difference between what Nikola is doing, and there's so much about what Nikola is doing that's the same, you know, it's copying the Tesla playbook, including the name, you know, where Tesla chose the inventor's last name, you know, Nikola went for his first name, Nikola Tesla. So, you know, not coincidental with the naming. And increasingly, it seems like Trevor Milton, their founder and now former CEO, he's now the chairman. They brought in another CEO. You know, he seems like he wants to be like Elon, even on Twitter. But, you know, what Nikola, you know, came to market wanting to do, I thought actually made a lot more sense than what Tesla is trying to do with the Semi, you know, using fuel cells. But, you know, 'cause hydrogen fuel cells, you know, for the kind of range that you need for a long haul truck, it's going to weigh probably about 10,000 pounds less than the batteries that you need to do the same kind of range for, you know, for the Tesla Semi. And when you're talking about a truck, you know, where you're weight limited to 80,000 pounds in most places, you know, that 10,000 pounds, that extra 10,000 pounds that you're not wasting on batteries, that can go into payload that generates revenue. So that's, you know, that actually makes a lot of sense. And then, you know, when you need to refuel, you can refuel that thing in just a few minutes, you know, whereas, you know, to do what Tesla is claiming with refueling the Semi, you know, 80% charge in 30 minutes, would require about a 1.6 or 1 megawatt charger, which is, you know, about four times more power than what you have today from the fastest supercharger.
1 megawatt charger.
One megawatt charger.
Come on.
And you know, those don't exist anywhere today. So no,
I mean, how are you gonna? What is the electrical like?
I can just imagine the size of the cable you're gonna need for this thing, and the cooling for that cable.
What's the transmission? Like the electrical transmission requirements, so you got a station with five of those, megawatts. Like what?
So you know, the obvious question with Nikola is, well, there aren't any hydrogen fueling stations in the middle of the country for long haul trucks either. Nikola is addressing that by they're building out a network of hydrogen stations across, you know, most of the major corridors across the country where most of the long haul trucking takes place, and what they're doing is, you know, today, you know, the hydrogen stations that are in California for cars like the Toyota Mirai and the Honda Clarity and the Hyundai Nexo, for those, you know, they have fairly limited number of cars that actually use those. So they actually bring in the hydrogen by truck and, you know, put it into a storage tank on site. That's not going to be practical, you know, when you're talking about, you know, taking it out to Kansas or Nebraska. You're not going to truck out hydrogen from refineries out to those locations. So they're actually going to be producing hydrogen on site from using water and electrolysis and using primarily renewable electricity to do the electrolysis, so solar and wind power. And they've, you know, they're working with some partners. They've ordered the equipment for the electrolyzers to do the hydrogen production. So they'll be able to support, you know, these trucks in the environment where they're going to be used. All good. They haven't actually done any of that yet. Okay.
We intend to.
The hydrogen trucks are supposed to hit production about 2022, 2023. You know, and the hydrogen stations are supposed to obviously need to be ready by then. But right now, Nikola has a valuation of $30 billion. And $0 in revenue. Okay. The other thing that got people all excited, the past week was, you know, news of the Badger, which is their pickup truck, you know, which looks really cool. Actually, you know, it looks much more like a traditional pickup truck than the Tesla Cybertruck. And, you know, as a truck, it would actually be probably a lot more useful than a Cybertruck.
Yeah.
That said, the Cybertruck, you can at least plug it in and charge it. The Badger is supposed to use the same fuel cell technology that they're using for the long haul trucks. And, you know, think about where most pickup trucks are sold, you know, places like Texas and Oklahoma. You know, these are not going to be long haul, you know, drivers. You know, these need, you know, need to be, they're going to be sold where people use pickup trucks, where if you're not in California, there's no hydrogen stations. Right. And, you know, unless you live close to one of these hydrogen stations that they're going to build on some interstates, this truck makes zero sense right now.
Well, so it's always an interesting bit of like cart and horse. You know, Tesla had to deal with some of the same stuff when they hit the market, and that's why they invested so much in their supercharger network. You know, that was, I think that's one of the key things that, as much as we bitch about Tesla, they actually did a really smart thing where they gave you the car and then they also gave you the infrastructure. And the supercharger experience is generally pretty good. Sometimes they don't charge as fast as they're advertised and that kind of stuff. Those are all solvable problems. And I think that's what I come back to when I'm looking at Nikola too, is they may not have the refueling architecture there, but that seems almost like an easier problem to solve than building, you know, electric charging stations, because it's real similar to how you refuel a gasoline car.
It's easier to solve for the long haul trucks.
Yeah.
Because, you know, of the more limited environments where they're going to be used, you don't need as many stations. But those pickup trucks, you know, right, you sell those to consumers, people expect to be able to use their vehicle anywhere, you know, wherever they go. And, you know, right now, unless you happen to live in California, you can't really do that, you know? So,
yeah.
So it's, you know, for the pickup truck right now, unless they're planning, you know, to build out a network of hydrogen stations across the country to support those too, that's not going to make any sense.
Well, yeah, I'm curious about how that's going to work. There's certainly an opportunity there where you can work with, you know, a large petroleum company. They have ways to produce and to deliver hydrogen. They have networks of stations already. It's not great, like, you know, but there's a sales pitch there.
Yeah, but right? I mean, they could have been doing that already.
Oh, they probably should have been, yes.
And they're not.
Yeah. Because
yeah, the oil companies are actually the ones who produce most of the hydrogen today.
Yeah, it's made from natural gas. It's a byproduct of cracking. So I guess my question is, because this is sort of a Silicon Valley company and there's so much subterfuge, like, do we know that they're actually not doing anything? Or
they're actually based in Arizona.
Oh, are they?
Yeah.
Phoenix. They give off a good vibe. That's still out west. That's, yeah, you know. Now I feel like an asshole. Anyway, but do we know for a fact they're actually not doing anything, or have they just not talked about it? You know, like.
You mean as far as a network of general purpose hydrogen stations?
Yeah, trying to partner or creating some like sort of more consumer facing, higher density, hydrogen charging stations. At the very least, right?
I don't know if they are doing anything or not. They haven't talked about it. I mean,
yeah,
with the trucks, with the long haul trucks, you know, they talked about that, you know, from day one. That was part of the plan from the beginning. Yeah. And you know, that's what helped them get a whole bunch of deposits from some really big fleet operators. For the Badger, they haven't said a thing about it. So my guess is that not much is happening there.
Yeah, that could be.
I think the Badger, I think, is just going to be vaporware for the foreseeable future.
Well, and I think that's actually a much harder thing to make any kind of profit on, no matter where they price it. Anywhere below like $300,000, it's just not going to. They're not going to get any return, no revenue from it, and. Yeah. I mean, you could easily, not easily, but you could conceivably solve that lack of hydrogen refueling. Again, truck it in and, you know, work on an infrastructure that is sort of more repeatable, sustainable in the meantime, but like get the fuel to the people. That's not as difficult as getting the electricity to the people in my mind.
Yeah, just. You know, right now there's about 120,000 gas stations in the United States. There's 40 hydrogen stations.
Right.
So.
But it's just a tanker truck, right? With another hose. It's fine. I know it's a lot more complicated than that, but it seems a little easier from the outside looking in to be able to say like, well, you could put hydrogen in the place where hydrogen is needed and then figure out, you know, with superchargers, right? You've got to put in transformers and all the different.
Yeah. I mean, you know, even a DC fast charging station, you know, costs a few $100,000 to install. Whereas a conventional hydrogen station like you have in California today is about 1.2, 1.3 million for one of those.
Yeah. So that's not great either. And then there's the whole thing that hydrogen explodes, but
well, so does gasoline.
Yeah, that's
true. And for that matter, so do lithium ion batteries.
That's also very true.
You puncture a lithium ion battery, it's not a good thing.
Now DC's nothing to mess with either.
And you know, hydrogen, you know, if you get a leak in a tank, you know, unless, you know, as long as you don't have an ignition source, you know, it's so light it's just going to evaporate, you know, disperse before, you know, pretty quickly. You know, so in a lot of ways, it's actually safer to work with than gasoline. But
yeah, just don't try to throw the rope down the dock in New Jersey and you'll be all right.
Yeah.
You know, I think this is a great pivot for us too, to speaking of electric cars that burn up, lemons has been doing a lot more to promote this is a great headline from Jalopnik. Lemons is doing more to promote or to advance electric racing than Le Mans, and I think that's true, because it's that sort of run what you brung ethos that
very
Lemons
much so.
Has and I mean that's the racing that we all say we want anyway, right? Like run regular cars, run crap boxes, make it fun, instead of some sort of like high dollar spec series. And that's what's going on at Tesla. They've got an extra purse for any team that can actually finish a race or win one of the races.
Win a race,
on electric
yeah.
race. Yeah. So that's really cool, actually.
Yeah. So, you know, for those not familiar with Lemons Racing, the basic premise is, you know, you can bring whatever, you know, race it, you know, they run like 12 to 24 hour endurance races. The main stipulation is that the car cannot cost more than $500. So anything up to $500 in value, not including the safety equipment. So not including the roll cage and fire extinguishers and harnesses and stuff like that. So, you know, I know a bunch of people that run Lemons, you know, they have, you know, all kinds of, you know, clap, you know, really terrible cars. And, you know, if you look around online, you can find some, if you look for photos of Lemons races, there's some hysterical stuff that's been raced. But, you know, and to try to enforce that $500 limit, one of the rules is that, you know, if, you know, you have to have, you know, receipts for everything. And if they think that you've cheated, that, you know, you've actually spent more than $500 on the car, if you race and win and they think you're too fast, they can buy your car, the organizers can buy your car from you for $500. So it's really, there's no incentive to spend more than $500. Fortunately, the $500 does not include your sweat equity, but for the electric racers, they have introduced a $50,000 prize that goes to the first team to win a race with electric power. And so far there's been two cars that have entered. Only one is even remotely any good. And that's an old Dodge Omni 024 that's been converted to electric. And the team that did this got initially filled it with a bunch of deep discharge RV batteries. But currently they're working on a configuration using a pair of used Chevy Volt batteries on swappable racks, so they can do quick battery change in the middle of the race. And for the for electric cars, they have the series is given an exclusion from the $500 limit for the electric powertrain stuff, because that stuff is clearly more expensive right now. So the rest of the car still can't cost more than $500, but you get an exception for an electric powertrain. So that way they can do the batteries. But it's going to be interesting to see who can, you know, who can build an EV that can actually win a Lemons race. That's going to be pretty hysterical to watch.
Well, it comes down to strategy. Certainly you have to be fast enough to win, but there's always attrition in endurance racing. So your thing just has to be fast enough to hold its own, but it doesn't have to be exotic.
Yeah.
You know,
well, and most Lemons cars are not very fast.
Yeah. The speed's not that high. That's not not the point with Lemons.
And it's the classic line about racing, you know, to finish first, you must finish.
Yeah.
And so like you said, you got to be there at the end. And if you can do that, you know, then you've got a chance.
Yeah. And it makes me wonder too, like, so the RV batteries, like that's just a heavy, inefficient.
Yeah,
they're lead acid. Yeah, it works. It doesn't work great, but you know, there's a whole cornucopia of options available to you to make one of these things on the cheap. Forklift parts are readily available, and you can use forklift motors and inverters and stuff. And you know, you do have a transmission, so you can get that thing up and. You know, fourth or fifth gear, not using that much energy. You know, electric motors have plenty of torque to drive that kind of stuff. And if you can figure out regen, like you could actually hang in
Well, you know, in the article here, you know, he talks about, you know, the potential of taking an old Toyota Celica or an early 90s Civic and, you know, installing the hybrid drive unit from a Prius. You know, so just take the, you know, the electric motor and transmission from a Prius, skip the engine, you know, and that's got 67 horsepower from a modern Prius, and almost 300 foot-pounds of torque. So, I mean, that would actually be a really good powertrain to use. And then you just have to figure out the battery side of it. You probably need some kind of swappable battery system, but it's definitely doable.
Yeah. See, this is the kind of thing that this improves the breed. Mm-hmm. Either the worst part is going to be if sort of automakers and big money concerns get in there and just ruin it all with their expensive tech, but I don't think.
I don't think that's going to happen in Lemons. Although there are a lot of auto engineers that do race Lemons.
Oh, I think it should be mandatory.
And a lot of journalists do it too.
Yeah, I think it's. I'd love to do it. I think it's one of those things that should be. It should be required if you're engineering cars, yeah. Because it really gives you that understanding of like what holds up, what doesn't, what you know, where the improvements can be had, and gets you really in touch with the product. And I honestly do believe that racing improves the breed, even the expensive stuff like NASCAR, all the stuff that those series.
Well, I don't know about NASCAR. You know.
No, I mean, I think
they only just recently switched from carburetors to fuel injection a couple of years ago.
I know, but those teams work with engineering, you know, suppliers and partners, and that stuff, like the techniques that they use to make it. Yes, it's like it's a spec series, and it's based on a, you know, an architecture that you would recognize in 1950, but everything is specialized, and to make it that specialized is, you know, takes a lot of talent and skill, and I think there's a lot of hard work that gets sort of shortchanged by the fact that it is, you know, NASCAR, but I don't think it's any less high tech in that series than you would find it at Le Mans or anything, you know. I think it's just different. All of that stuff does wind up in our cars eventually. And it is true, as much as you may think it doesn't matter anymore. I think it actually really does. And then we've seen that with the Endurance series, with electric cars. It's hard to do. And so I'm glad that we're doing it at both ends, and we should definitely do Lemons when we can.
Yeah, absolutely.
We've covered all of our topics. We had some actual listener feedback, which is nice. They weren't swearing at us.
we actually had a couple of good questions here. So let's see, let me find the first one here. So first one from Gareth Thomas, classic car challenge. You magically get a new extra garage bay and $15,000, but you must buy a classic car. What do you each get? Well, let's define classic car as anything that's at least 25 years old and it can't be a car you already own.
Hmm. Well, that's not a problem. In terms of the car I already own, I shipped off the Crown Victoria to my brother. So he gets the family heirloom. So now it's just the Jeep, and that's not classic yet. So, it's a little difficult. I did some thinking about this. It's really hard to narrow it down to just one. What do you have?
Well, I mean, you know, the obvious choice here would be, you know, an early NA Miata. You know, which you can still find really nice examples for under 15 grand, although they have been getting more expensive in the last couple of years. But I was taking a look around, even on Bring a Trailer, where the prices tend to be elevated. You know, there were some 90, 91 Miatas, you know, with, you know, under 100,000 miles on them, you know, for under 10 grand. But since I already own a 1990 Miata, you know, that obviously disqualifies that one for me. So I would say the one I would probably choose is second generation Toyota MR2, you know, which, you know, you can get those for, you know, easily for under 15 grand. You know, the first gen were pretty cool, but they were a little too small and too tight for my taste. But, you know, I really like the look of the second gen MR2. The third gen was the convertible, and I think that might fall, outside of the 25-year range. I can't remember what year those came out. I think they came out in 95. So that might not qualify. So, but the second generation MR2, I think, would probably be the one that I would pick.
Okay. It's still tough. There's a lot of cars I'd like. You know, I was thinking, I was like, I always wanted to have a, you know, an MN12 Thunderbird Super Coupe. That's maybe not weird enough.
Didn't say anything about weird.
Yeah, I know. It's, that's sort of my own kind of criteria. You know, air-cooled Volkswagens left a big mark on me. So a 412, especially like a 412 wagon would
What about a Corvair?
Kind of cool. A Corvair would be okay. Would not mind a Corvair. You know, so it's really, those are sort of like, I go for the weirder stuff. First generation CRX.
Oh yeah. Nice. That's a good choice. Yeah.
Yeah. Especially the SI. Those are super rare now. You don't even see them anywhere. And
most of them have rusted away.
Yeah, that's true. I thought about the Thunderbird. I was like, that's such a, like, that's such like an extension of the 60s and 70s. Like, what else do you see very little of, that, you know, what's the car that would make me stop and just talk to the owner for 20 minutes if I saw it at like a car show or something? And it is, it's weird stuff. Like that CRX or an Isuzu Stylus.
Yeah.
I like the different stuff. So, those are two things I'd be searching for, or three things. So for the 412 or a 69 Squareback. And if with 15 grand, you can get a pretty nice air cooled VW, and then you can have fun sort of swapping engines and stuff and playing around with it. There's plenty of variety there. The CRX, I'd probably just want to leave pretty stock, the CRX SI. And then the Isuzu, the Stylus. Those can be a lot of fun. There's a lot of parts bin swapping you can do with those cars. You can, some of the parts are really rare, but you can make your own sort of rally all-wheel drive version of it.
Yeah, there's still a really thriving aftermarket. Yeah, there were so many of those air-cooled VWs built over the years that there's lots of parts that you can find. There's lots of people doing stuff with them. You know, it's easy to find all kinds of aftermarket things that you can add to that to make it more interesting, you know, or do stuff with it.
Yeah. Well, and you know, it's very much like, it's funny you mentioned the Corvair. Like, that's one of the things that, what gets me about the air-cooled Volkswagens and the Corvair too, is just, the depth of engineering on display. There's a lot of challenges they had to solve, especially with the Corvair.
Yeah.
That they solved very, very methodically, very cleverly. You know, think about cooling that middle cylinder on that flat six with air cooling, like just keeping that cylinder head from melting those middle cylinders. It's not easy, you know, and they figured it out in, you know, 1956.
Yeah. They put all their effort into cooling that, and then went with swing axles. So,
yeah. Well, yeah. I mean,
no engineering resources left for a decent suspension.
But that's one. you just got to stagger the tire pressure. That's one of the things that keeps me out, like thinking more modern too, is the stuff, even the 412 would be mid 70s. Early to mid 70s. And we're just at a place where cars are safer, cleaner, more efficient when you get into the 80s. And it really does make a difference. You know, yeah, the CRX is small, but it's not, the steering column's not going to spear you. You know, like,
of course, the body's just going to, you know, kind of collapse like a ball of aluminum foil, but
yeah, don't hit anything. It's nimble though. The only car that could beat it in what, 84 when it debuted, the only car that could outslalom it was a Ferrari Testarossa. So
I know. And you know, the CRX was about half the width of the Ferrari. So
yeah, that's true. The Testarossa is really wide. I didn't realize how wide it was until I saw some.
A friend of mine has a rare CRX convertible back in the mid '80s. Richard Strayman, who did a lot of convertible conversions back then, including the Testarossa. He built some CRX convertibles, and he's got one. He bought it about 3 years ago, I think. Bought it out in California or New Mexico and drove it back to Michigan. And you sit in this thing. It's amazing how tiny this – I mean, it makes my Miata look big.
Yeah.
It's funny.
And it is, it's especially now where everything is so huge, because it was a small car even when it was new, but it wasn't that small. You know, it was a Civic.
But yeah, I mean, you know, the CRX only weighed, I think, about 1,700 pounds.
Yeah, that's quite so much fun.
You know, it didn't have much power, but you know, you didn't need it with that kind of weight. You know,
yeah, well, it's not a drag racer. That's not not what it's for.
But with so little weight, you know, you don't need much tire either, you know, to still have great handling.
Well, that's a good point. And I wonder, so you're not running into this with your Miata now, are you, where you can't find good tires in the right size?
No, the Miata is new enough. And the guy I bought it from actually put on a set of 15-inch wheels.
Yeah.
But even 14s, you know, the stock wheels on there were 14s. So you can still find decent 14-inch wheels or 14-inch tires. You know, but things like the 13s, you know, that were on those early CRXs, and 12s, you know, that were on some, you know, a lot of, cars in the 70s, 60s and 70s, and even into the early 80s, are getting to be really hard to find.
Yeah. You can find tires that will fit, but the compound is, there's good luck with that, like high performance tire. Like it just doesn't exist anymore.
Right.
So those are considerations too. I guess sort of the last thing that pops to mind would be a first or second generation RX-7. So,
yeah, that's another great one. That, you know, definitely fits, especially the first gen fits into that price point. Now, you know, with that, especially the first gen, you know, you're depending on where you live, you may have a very hard time getting it to pass emissions.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, and they do consume a lot of oil, and they're, you know, they also consume a lot of gasoline. So you got to keep that in mind, but you can get those for a pretty decent price. And, you know, a lot of them still in pretty good condition.
Yeah. Well, it's too bad Rebecca's not here. I'd love to hear what her choices are. We'll have to keep this question around and pose it to her next time.
All right. So the other question came from Sam Monteith. Let's see. We're in the market for a new car this year. We keep our cars about 10 years or more, so we've stayed with Toyota for years. We currently have a 2006 IS250, Lexus IS250, a 2012 Tundra, and a 2017 RAV4. My wife wanted an electric car, but we decided we'll most likely get a hybrid. I'm very interested in the RAV4 plug-in hybrid. I see that it has been delayed a bit due in the fall. I think it's still coming late summer, or, you know, definitely by the fall it'll be here. There may have been some delays, but it won't be by much. We like that for short trips. It can operate like an electric car. I'm concerned with the first year of a new car, quality issues. Your thoughts? Is this powertrain in any other cars anywhere? I'd love to see a detailed review of the car. I just read that Ford's coming out with the Escape plug-in hybrid, which we talked about earlier. I do plan to do a review of that as soon as I can get my hands on one. Comparison to would be great. We're also considering a traditional hybrid and looking at the Honda CR-V or the RAV4. Rebecca's report on the noisy CR-V electric motor is very concerning. I do consider a Honda number one or two brand to Toyota for reliability. And I would consider your response. I would appreciate a response if you plan on these reviews. So, I'm getting a CR-V hybrid in a couple of weeks to drive. So we'll let you know pretty soon if that was a one-off problem in the car Rebecca drove, or if it's a common issue. But, you know, certainly, you know, the plug-in hybrid RAV4, you know, even though it's first year for that model, I would not be concerned about it, because basically, you know, it's the same hardware that's in the existing RAV4 hybrid and that Toyota uses in pretty much every hybrid they build. You know, they almost all of their mainstream models are available with hybrid powertrains, and they're all basically the same. In some cases, you know, the motor's scaled up or down a little bit depending on the size of the vehicle. But, you know, in the RAV4, you know, the only notable difference between the regular RAV4 hybrid and the plug-in is going to be the size of the battery. You know, so you're going to be carrying, you know, dragging around a little more weight for that battery. But, you know, aside from that, I wouldn't worry about the reliability of it at all. And frankly, the same is true, you know, for the Ford as well, for the Escape plug-in hybrid. You know, the RAV4, at least based on, you know, we haven't got official EPA numbers on it yet. You know, Toyota, the numbers Toyota's projected are a little bit more for range for the RAV than what Ford's got for the Escape. But, you know, they're both, you know, pretty close, you know, that upper 30s to 40 mile range, which, you know, for most of your driving means you can go without using any gas. And then, you know, when you want to do a road trip, you just go. And, you know, these modern plug-ins, you know, unlike, you know, the C-Max plug-in hybrid or the Fusion Energy plug-in hybrid that Ford sold before, these were actually designed, you know, to package protect for the battery anyway. So, you know, you don't give up in either the RAV or the Ford, you're not giving up any cargo space to that battery. You know, it all fits in there really nicely. So it's, you know, they're both going to be really practical alternatives for you.
I think you need to try them, because they're all so similar. They're all like right on top of each other, the CR-V, the RAV4, and the Escape. And you probably don't even need to wait until the hybrids are all out. Just go try them now and get a sense of the flavor of the vehicle, because the thing that's going to probably make the sale for you is whether you can figure out how everything works. Again, we come back to just operating the car and the infotainment and the view out and the ride and drive character. I think that, hybrid aside, that's what sets these three apart from each other. And I can't say that any of them are necessarily better than the other. They're all very competitive. They all have a slightly different flavor. And so you got to figure out which you like the best. I know that of the three, I probably like the Ford's infotainment the best, because Toyota's getting a little better. Honda's, I don't know. It's been a while since I've been in a CR-V, but you know, those two, they seem to, while they are market leaders, they seem to lag. And so if that's important to you, if you do, you know, Apple CarPlay or Android Auto, or you just, you know, you need nav a lot or whatever, play with them and go spend some time, some research. I do wonder why the decision to go hybrid versus EV. I wonder if that comes back to wanting to cover all the bases and have a vehicle that you don't have range anxiety or anything, but you have a couple of other vehicles. You know, the IS250 is a little bit tight. The Tundra is a little bit inefficient. So maybe if you wanted something that you could do longer trips.
Well, and they have a 2017 RAV4 already.
Yeah.
I think they're probably replacing the IS, which is the oldest of the three okay. they have.
Because I was going to say, like, if you've got something that you can do a road trip with that you trust, then there's really not an argument for not going full EV. But, well, that's not true. There's less of an argument.
You know, it depends on where you live. I mean, you know, presumably since they have three vehicles, I'm assuming they live, you know, a single family home, you know, have a driveway and a garage, so they could plug in. I'm assuming they don't live in an apartment with those three vehicles.
Oh, he says they're in California, about an hour from Petaluma. So,
oh, okay.
Northern California.
Oh, so. Yeah. So, you know, that's, you know, easy climate. So you're not going to be worrying about winter weather. You know, I wouldn't rule out an EV. You know, I would definitely, you know, if you want to look at an EV, I would definitely look at the Kia Niro, electric. And actually the Nero is also available as both a hybrid and a plug-in hybrid, but you know, the electric, you know, has 240 mile range. You also take a look at the Hyundai Kona electric. The Kona has got about 260 mile range, 259 miles.
Kona's a little tight compared to these.
That's what I was going to say. The Kona's back seat is definitely tighter. The Nero is a little, you know, a little roomier, a little more practical. Look at the Chevy Bolt. You know, the Bolt is an excellent car. You know, got lots of room inside, you know, despite its small physical footprint on the road, it's surprisingly roomy inside, you know, decent cargo space. It's pretty reasonably priced as well. So, you know, definitely take a look at those three electrics as well. But yeah, I mean, even before the plug-in hybrids are on the dealer lots, you know, go and take a look at the hybrid versions, you know, go drive those, you know, because the hybrids are going to drive basically the same as the plug-in hybrid.
Yeah, that's true.
Except that you're going to go farther on electricity. So, you know, go drive them, you know, see if you like the way they look and they feel and the controls work for you. And try out those three electrics, the Kona, the Nero, and the Bolt.
Okay. That we solve that problem. Let us know what you get.
Yeah. All right. And I think with that, let's call it a show.
Yeah. So we'll be back soon. So thanks for listening. And you know where to hit us up. So please keep doing so. And I will let you know what I wind up with when I'm car shopping. I've moved on from Mercedes wagons. I had that Silverado that I talked about a couple weeks ago. I was like, man, it's not bad having a truck. So now I'm like, it's a lot harder to find a good used pickup truck than it is to find a good used Mercedes wagon.
Actually, now that you mentioned the Mercedes, you know, I mean, that, you know, if you could have gotten that for 15 grand, that would have been it wasn't 25 years old though. So never mind.
No, I mean, you can definitely get you can get an old Mercedes, but I wanted something weirder.
Yeah. All right.
Thanks for listening.
Talk to you next time.
It's time to get that hernia repaired. And who better to do it than a leading clinical facility? JBR Clinical Research is currently recruiting participants for an investigational pain reduction medication study following hernia repair surgery. If you're between the ages of 18 to 75, you may qualify to receive study-related medication and no-cost hernia repair by a board-certified surgeon. You may even be compensated up to $2,000 for time and travel. To participate, call 801-261-2000 or apply at JBR Clinical Research.
The Utah Newborn Safe Haven Law allows birth parents or someone they choose to safely and anonymously give up their newborn at any Utah hospital. There are no names, blame, or shame, only love and respect. Your privacy is important, and so is the future of the newborn. The baby will be cared for and placed in a loving and welcoming home. For more details and information, please visit UtahSafeHaven.org. That's UtahSafeHaven.org.